Happy New Year! It's episode 130 of the Hodgepodge Podcast. I'm your host, Doug.
And I'm Dirty A. As the name suggests, we're going to talk about a hodgepodge of topics from movies, music, TV, and other pop culture events.
And on this episode, we're wrapping up 2016 with discussions on the films Jackie, Fences, and Passengers. You can reach us at thehodgepodgepodcast@gmail.com or on our website, thehodgepodgepodcast.com, or look for us on iTunes and YouTube and subscribe, or head on over to Facebook, search for The Hodgepodge Podcast, and like our page. And we're recording this prior to New Year's, so we're hoping that there's no gigantic news that happens for the rest of the week. We just recorded our retrospective episode about Carrie Fisher and George Michael, so if we seem a little morose as we're talking about these movies, it's not because they're all terrible, one of them is, but it's because we're having a little bit of a sadness hangover, yeah. We'll say. At the box office, Rogue One is still making all the money. We just saw Fences today, and we were shocked at the amount of people that were at the movie theater on a Tuesday morning or Tuesday afternoon.
Seriously.
I mean, there's a lot of people there. We just saw... Did we talk about the Blade Runner trailer?
I think we mentioned it last time.
Blade Runner has a trailer out there, an announcement trailer.
It's pretty cool.
It looks pretty cool.
Blade Runner 2049.
And you don't get much about the plot at all because this movie's not coming out till October. But you do get to see Harrison Ford in it. It mainly focuses on Ryan Gosling. And it's really atmospheric. It really is about the imagery and stuff like that, which is a lot of what Blade Runner was too. About the world that Ridley Scott created.
I'm sorry, but that's all Blade Runner was about.
No,
Doug and I differ from Blade Runner because I did not find it as, I don't know what the word is, but iconic. I didn't find it as world building as, I guess, you and a lot of other people. It just didn't do much for me.
You know, most people.
I wouldn't say most people.
Yeah, most people.
I wouldn't say most people.
I'd say most people.
I'd say most people never saw Blade Runner.
That's probably true. It didn't do well at the box office.
Exactly.
It became a cult hit when it hit video.
Yeah, it was definitely cult. Yeah.
But yeah, so that comes out in October. It's directed by, you know, our current favorite director, Denis Villeneuve. And
Which bodes very well for this movie. Because that man knocks him out of the park.
He does. And apparently he is also in talks to direct Dune, which would be awesome.
Oh, man, that's right up his alley.
That would be great.
I bet you he'll put some giant spiders in there.
I hope so. Yeah. And then on Christmas Day, 20th Century Fox released the first trailer for this new horror movie called Alien. I thought Sigourney Weaver was supposed to be in it, but it's not. It's Catherine Waterston. And I thought it was supposed to look a lot older, but it actually looks pretty modern.
Yeah.
The trailer for Alien Covenant came out. Yeah. This is the
Christmas Day.
This is the second prequel for Aliens.
Right. There's Prometheus, which now this, Doug loved.
I hated it. And now there's this. And Michael Fassbender is back, but clearly it's not picking up the story from Prometheus.
That's right. Yeah. It can't be an immediate
because he was just a head at the end of that movie and now he's a full robot.
This is supposedly, whereas they said Prometheus wasn't the direct tie-in to Alien, whatever.
This is
and
an
don't
Alien
get me wrong.
Movie.
Look, I actually enjoyed Prometheus, whereas you didn't. But when that movie came out, to say it wasn't a direct tie-in to Alien was just stupid.
Right? Yeah.
Clearly, it was.
Yes.
But this one is the one that's being billed as the direct tie-in.
Yeah.
I liked the trailer. I did felt it was a little schlocky though, in that it just felt like it wanted to get all the beats in.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, here's the alien popping out of the guy's body.
Yeah.
Oh, here's the little girl who's in peril, I don't need to see everything over again. It's like they just tried to cram it all in.
It's been there, done that. That's literally what it felt like. It's like we've seen this movie already.
Well, that's every Alien movie. I mean, in a horror genre, you got to take that with a grain of salt.
But I think it also shows the limitations of the property. I mean, there's only so much. Like we talked about this with Terminator when we did Terminator Genesis last year, you know, and it, you know, just how limited that. property is. Like, you can only do so much with it.
Sure.
And I would say, short of having the aliens come to Earth, there's really not much more you can do with it.
Well, you know, I mean, we just saw a review lately of some people that were saying the same thing about Star Wars.
Yeah, that's
there's
true.
Only so much you can do with it. It's not exactly a large universe.
That's true. Red Letter Media did their Half in the Bag episode.
And they're not wrong.
No. Rich Evans basically said the dirty little secret about Star Wars is that it's very limited. And we'll see how limited it is going forward.
So, yeah, I don't disagree with you at all. But being a horror movie fan and having that ingrained in my whole life, I'm accustomed to seeing these movies over and over again, and it basically, I mean, Alien and Aliens, okay, those were kind of distinctly separate.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, James Cameron did something completely different.
Yeah, he did. They went a different direction between those two, but after that, they're kind of the same,
I guess. Then it got convoluted, but
as every horror movie franchise, that's
so. I mean, I'm going to see it. I mean, you know, I'm not a big horror guy, but I like Alien. Right. I like Aliens.
It's funny how you say that. I'm not a big horror guy, but I'm going to see Alien. Because Alien has always had that kind of avant-garde, artsy feel to horror.
Right.
But Ridley Scott and James Cameron brought that to the franchise.
But the thing is like, my introduction to Alien, the Alien franchise, was Aliens. I didn't see the original until much later. Yeah,
which is a fantastic movie.
Yeah, it is. It's a great movie. Yeah. It's a great movie. But I didn't see it until after
you
Aliens.
Saw the action-packed Cameron version.
Right, so... Yeah.
Which is almost less horror and more action.
It is, yeah. It's more of a sci-fi action thriller.
Yeah.
But what I found interesting also is that they moved this up to May. There's another movie coming out that was supposed to be coming out in May, but I'm getting conflicting reports. I think they moved it to March. This is Life with Ryan Reynolds and Jake Gyllenhaal, which looks like it's basically a Prometheus/Alien ripoff.
I'm looking forward to that movie, but
me too.
Yeah,
but it's like they're jockeying. It's like which Alien ripoff can get to the theaters first, the kind of sort of legitimate one, or this other one that's kind of a knockoff.
All I know is when I see that trailer and I see the what I assume is like a scientist touching the organism with his bare hand that he doesn't know anything about, I'm like, well, you deserve to die.
Well, that's like Billy Crudup in the Alien thing. Yeah. He's like, this thing opens, he goes, oh, let me stick my face in here. What is this gonna do?
You deserve to die, motherfucker.
And now the alien's gonna have the powers of Dr. Manhattan. God, so that's not good.
No.
Now they're unstoppable.
Yeah.
I don't even know how those other movies even
happen.
And
big blue dicks.
Yes.
Yeah.
And of course, once again, with Alien Covenant, it's another goddamn fucking prequel, which I'm just tired of prequels. Yeah. Just stop it.
It is the way of Hollywood today. It's the complete juxtaposition of them trying to make something new again by doing something old.
I mean, if they were going to do that, then they should have done freaking Neil Blomkamp's idea, which was Alien 5. Which essentially was going to ignore 3 and 4.
Just cut them out. Which Sigourney Weaver even loved, she said.
Yeah, well, because she was going to be in it.
Well, a little bit of self-sustainment there.
We'll
see how this goes. It's not that I'm not saying I have high expectations, but I like Prometheus a lot more than most people do.
Yeah, I mean, there were elements of Prometheus I liked, but overall the movie was just. It's kind of similar to a movie we're going to talk about today, that the window dressing's real nice, but...
Well, maybe that makes sense as to why I enjoy it.
Exactly, yes. But first, let's talk about a movie that we both liked but kind of disagreed on. This was a movie by director Pablo Larraine. I believe this is his first English-speaking movie, and that is Jackie, starring Natalie Portman.
She plays a track and field runner, Jackie Joyner Kersee.
No, and it's not about Jack A. either, from 227.
Oh, okay.
No, it's not about that either.
Okay, well, maybe I missed the mark on the movie completely.
Maybe that's why you didn't enjoy the movie though as much as I did. It's about, if you don't know, if you can't tell from the fucking poster for the movie, it's about...
Well, that's assuming people have seen the poster for this movie.
That's true, too.
Very small release.
Yes. Jackie is a portrait a biopic portrait, but it's not really a biopic because it really doesn't tell her whole story.
It's a just, slice of life. It's a day in the life of almost.
Well, yeah, several days around and after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and it's about Jackie Kennedy. Natalie Portman stars as Jackie Kennedy, and she is phenomenal in this movie.
Yeah, she does. She's very well. She does this very well and understated.
Yeah,
she's not over the top with anything.
No, but a lot of people I think complain about Natalie Portman. Like, she's kind of like the Nolan of actresses. Like, people are like, well, she doesn't really show like a lot of emotion and stuff like that. She does in this.
Yeah,
there are two scenes in particular that really got to me. One was when it was immediately after the assassination when she was on the Air Force One in the bathroom. And they and Lorraine does a lot of extreme close-ups in this film. A lot of, like, even the dialogue scenes between two characters is a lot of close-ups. It's filmed, I would say, in a very arty way.
It was, and honestly, though, that I didn't, that annoyed me more than.
See, I didn't annoy me.
But for me, that's, and I'm not going to go so far as to say that it was this ham-fisted in this movie, but for me, that's the sign of a terrible director, is when you just have close-up after close-up after close-up. There was a reason for it here.
Right.
I'm not saying that he's a terrible director, but it just got annoying to me.
Oh, see, not me. I thought it created a very intimate space for this very intimate picture.
I mean, it was intimate, all right. Right up to the scene of nose, bridge of nose, around the camera.
And then the other scene for me was when she had to tell the kids that daddy wasn't coming home ever again. That was a tough scene. I mean, there's really not much to tell about the plot. It's basically you watch as she and it kind of jumps around the timeline, which I know you weren't a big fan of. It jumps back and forth around the timeline, and also to her tour of the White House. TV special that she did back in 62.
That was the framework I didn't like so much. Yeah. Some of the I didn't mind all the timeline jumping, but that framing it within this video movie that she had done for the White House, I didn't do it for me.
Right. I mean, but I think that was to frame it with like how she understood history.
That was her legacy,
right? History and legacy and all that kind of stuff. Because really, what the movie is about, it's also framed with a interview that she gives to Life magazine. I say interview in quotes because she basically
her version of what she wanted people
what to she know. Wanted people to know. Yeah. And they never name him in this. Billy Crudup plays the journalist, and two Billy Crudup mentions in
that's right.
An episode.
Oh man.
He plays the journalist. They never mention him, but he was basically playing Theodore H. White, who was a writer for Life magazine, and he also did he did books about the presidential elections, I think from 60, 64, 68. I can't remember if he didn't do one for 72. I can't remember. But, and the first one was like a huge, like explosive bestseller. And then after he did that, all these other people started doing books based on the presidential elections and stuff like that. But he essentially, his story for Life magazine is what basically married the Kennedy presidency to the imagery of Camelot. And it's because that's what Jackie wanted it to be.
Yeah, and that was the only interesting thing I took out of this
movie.
And we'll get into that more later. But yeah, we all know now that is something that
the Kennedy.
The Kennedy administration was kind of seen as this like a Camelot,
right?
And
it's because of this story.
And what you didn't know, what we may not know as a younger generation, is that wasn't, like, when he was in office, that's not necessarily, was not the imagery. It was because of this interview that she gave it this imagery.
Right. And that became the mythology of the Kennedy presidency. Because she, you can see her throughout the movie subtly saying, oh, do you know who, you know, McKinley is? Do you know who Garfield is? People are like, no. And she goes, oh, they were also assassinated presidents.
Actually, not so subtly, too.
Yes, true. But I mean, like, you could see that she was trying to secure Jack Kennedy's legacy.
She was very worried about how his legacy would be viewed in the history
right.
of this country.
They felt that she felt that he would go down as just an assassinated president, and right. he wouldn't be remembered. She was very worried about that.
Yeah, she doesn't need to be worried.
Yeah, and she, I think the thing that really impressed me about this film and her performance is that I think people around her kind of looked at her as kind of like a silly little girl. And even Jack treated her like a silly little girl. Yeah. But she was not. She was a strong woman, and she knew what she wanted and knew what she had to get done. And
she was very much behind the scenes.
Yes.
I mean, the thing is, different times, right?
Yeah.
Because even back then, you know, look at what her responsibility was as a first lady.
Right.
Decorating.
Yeah, decorating the
White House. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. But what she did was she took that and turned it into more.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
She turned it into, I'm right. not decorating, I am preserving history.
Right.
And I'm bringing it back into the White House.
And she became a style icon as well.
Of course.
And she...
Well, I think she was just a style icon before. I mean, she was known for her
right.
fashion being in...
Right.
Before that, but yes.
But the other angle that they show about the legacy is Peter Sarsgaard plays Bobby Kennedy, and he does a good job here. I mean, the whole cast does a great job, I thought. He plays Bobby Kennedy, and he's also concerned about the legacy because there's a scene between him and Jackie where he's just like, what the fuck did we even do? He's like, there was so much stuff that we could have done, and now he's gone, and now we can't. Now we've teed it all up for Lyndon Johnson to do it. And sure enough, he was kind of right. You know, Lyndon Johnson got the Civil Rights Act passed, and he thought it was bad that they teed up Vietnam for Lyndon Johnson. Little did he know what a fucking quagmire that was.
That's true, but you know, to Johnson's credit, he did go forward with it,
and he did. He did.
He wasn't the greatest because
if you watch a lot of Lyndon Johnson stuff, I guess, like, you know, what was the one with Cranston, All the Way?
Oh, right. Yeah. If you watch it,
he was very conscious about not dropping the ball on Kennedy's legacy as well. Yeah.
He maybe even didn't believe in it as fully as Kennedy.
Right.
Not maybe. He didn't. It was right. more of a means to an end for him.
Right.
But at least he did it.
Yeah.
And I think that Jackie was so worried about Jack's legacy, at least in terms of the way this movie portrays it.
Right.
It's because they had such grand ideas for what they could do.
Right.
What they could accomplish.
Right.
And they just didn't get to do any of it.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
You know.
And also, Lyndon Johnson was also very interested in finding a nice pair of slacks.
That doesn't rub on the crotch.
Right. And up my bunghole.
Up the bunghole.
John Carroll Lynch plays Lyndon Johnson. He's not a big part of the movie because it's more about Jackie and Bobby and dealing with the...
Which is also, it's also funny, the scenes that I really enjoyed the most were when Bobby was in the scene, mm-hmm. and it was clear that Lyndon Johnson, who was the president at this time, was right. still kind of taking cues from Bobby.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, yes and no.
You know what I'm saying, though? Like, right. Bobby was like, sit down.
Right.
Like, what'd you say? Okay, I'll sit. Yeah. It was pretty funny. And the scene that struck me that I really liked was, and gosh, I wish I can't remember if it was the chief of staff or who it was. I think it probably was. But when Jackie goes into the office to talk about the funeral.
You mean Johnson's chief of staff?
Johnson's chief of staff.
That's Jack Valenti, played by Max Casella.
Well, is it chief of staff? Is that who he was?
He may have been, yeah.
Right. But when she goes in there to talk about that, and she's very subtle in that conversation, and that kind of was, to me, that was epitome of what they wanted, how they were framing her.
Yeah.
You know, she goes into let him know that she's changed her mind again, and that they will be marching for President Kennedy's funeral.
She wanted him to have as an elaborate,
very grandiose, very fairy tale
as Lincoln.
Yeah, and so, but of course, the concern there was, well, he was just assassinated. We can't very well have these other heads of state walking right and.
Yeah,
and open
when they didn't know who did it and why, and, you know, yeah.
But she was, at the end, she was adamant about it. She said, this is the way he's going to be remembered, and that scene where you know, she walks out saying, "I'm just doing my job."
Yeah,
you know, that it was a brilliant scene.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I really, really enjoyed this movie. I thought it was great. The majority of it obviously is powered by Natalie Portman's performance, because she's just, like I said, she's phenomenal in this. If she doesn't win the Oscar at this point,
I agree with that. I didn't, the movie, and don't get me wrong when I say you just love the movie, whereas I liked it. That's the difference. But she was phenomenal.
Yeah, she was great.
She's really good.
Yeah.
And she definitely, I certainly can't think of anyone who could possibly be up against her
for best actress. I mean, you know, I don't know.
Which honestly is actually, that speaks volumes to another issue
we
have.
That's true. That, yeah, that's true.
That we can't.
I mean, well, I mean, to be fair, you know, we didn't see 20th Century Women, so, you know, Annette Bening's in that. Okay. You know, so to be fair, there's some movies we haven't seen.
Although I don't think I want to see that movie.
I don't know if I do either.
It doesn't look that great.
I heard. Well, I don't know. Part of it intrigued me, but then I heard a bad review. But I don't know.
But if that's a, you know, reliable source. That, right? Is that right. There's it just seems
no. Yeah.
There's not a there's not a lot large pool.
I mean,
to pick from.
But it's also because of how we felt about a lot of the movies that came out this year. You that's know, true. like Emma Stone. People would say she's probably a front runner as well for La La Land. But you and I liked La La Land, but we didn't love it. And you know,
I really like La La Land.
I know you really liked it, but I mean, but you wouldn't put it on the top of your list, would you?
Oh, not like, I mean, if I think it's in my top 10.
That I mean, not, at the top.
No,
right.
Not at
so
all. No.
Clearly. Maybe Amy Adams can get nominated.
But what
for,
I'm saying is, I don't think this movie doesn't even touch my top 10.
Yep.
Nope.
You know, Amy Adams was great in Arrival. Maybe she'll get
A
nod for
you know
that,
what?
You know?
Yes, Amy Adams, maybe, but that's not the same level as we see here, I don't think.
And we haven't... No. I mean, Amy Adams is great in that movie, don't get me wrong, but no. Natalie Portman blows everybody away in this. And but also,
to be fair, Doug is very biased when it comes to Natalie Portman.
She's Princess Leia's mother. And
her worst role ever. Most stoic piece of shit ever.
God, I think that's where a lot of it
who
comes
just
from.
Makes terrible decisions.
Yeah, I think that's where it comes from, where people say she's a bad actress. I mean, I thought she was great when she won for Black Swan. I thought she was great.
Especially
that lesbian scene with Mila Kunis.
Well, phenomenal.
That's on repeat.
That's phenomenal.
And also, we haven't seen Hidden Figures yet because that hasn't released in our area yet. Yeah. But I've heard that the performances in that. You know, Taraji P. Henson, Octavia Spencer, and Janelle Monáe. I heard all three of them are great in that movie.
Who we just saw?
In the trailer.
Yep.
Yes, because for the movie we are going to talk about next, we just got out of Fences with Denzel Washington, directed by Denzel Washington.
Wonder how you got that gig.
Yeah, I know. Viola Davis. It's based on and... The screenplay was written by August Wilson.
Oh, August, yes, that's right.
I was trying to pull up my IMDb.
Did it say what year this play was written?
You know what? I don't know. I'd have to look that up in Wikipedia.
I remember in college, my buddy reading the play. He was an English major, and I don't remember if it had just come out or what. But I'll tell you what, it is a good movie. It was certainly wasn't changed much from a standpoint of it being looking like a play.
Yes.
It felt very much like a play.
Yes, it did.
And
we should also say that Washington and Davis played these roles on Broadway.
That's right.
And I believe I believe they both won Tonys for it.
I know
Denzel Washington.
Yeah, this was something that they were akin to doing before. They knew the material inside and out, which showed and translated very easily onto the screen.
Right.
With lesser actors, this movie would have been real boring real fast.
Yes.
But they give such entertaining, enthralling performances, particularly Denzel.
Denzel's fantastic.
Well,
in this.
I say particularly Denzel because his character is the crux of the story.
Right. She's more of a supporting
but
character.
But Davis, I mean, when she is allowed to show her range. For the purpose of the story, it shines.
Yes.
She's
fantastic. She has that one scene where they have it out, and she's fantastic in that scene. That almost reminded me a little bit. I mean, she is obviously in this movie more than she was in this movie I'm about to mention, but that reminded me of when she got nominated for Doubt.
Yeah.
And she basically only had that one scene.
That's right. She was on screen for maybe 5 minutes.
And she got Best Supporting Actress. But she will definitely get nominated for Best Supporting Actress for this.
Yes.
Also, you've got Stephen Henderson is in this. He plays Bono. I mean, Jim Bono. yeah. He's Denzel Washington.
Also has glaucoma.
Yes. Denzel Washington plays Troy Maxson, and Bono is his best friend. And Viola Davis plays Denzel's wife, Rose. Jovan Adepo plays their son, Corey. And there's Russell Hornsby, who plays Denzel's son from another previous mother, Lyons.
Her previous mother.
Lyons. Yeah. And then the heartbreaking performance has to go to Michael T. Williamson, who plays Gabriel, who's Troy's brother. Who is mentally
wounded from the war?
Wounded from the World War II, because this takes place in the '50s.
Yeah,
he was wounded in the war, and he has a metal plate in his head. Now he's basically brain damaged. Basically, yeah. he's mentally impaired, and he's so sweet. He's such a sweet
kind of walks around town, and he's the he's the town idiot that the kids seem to all make fun of.
Yeah,
and his brother.
Oh, I don't know if the kids were making fun of him. They were. I think they were more like. I don't know. I took it as they saw him as like he was a fun guy that they.
I got the sense they were making fun of him when Denzel came out. That's why they all ran away.
Oh, maybe kind of maybe
telling them.
Yeah,
leave my brother alone, kind of thing.
Maybe, I don't know. But, I mean, because he was holding hands with one of them.
You're right. I don't know.
It seemed like it was more like
maybe he was more innocent than I thought.
Yeah, yeah.
But in any
you're
case,
you're just cynical.
That's a fact. But in any case, like Denzel's the brother that takes care of him one way. He does feel a responsibility towards him. He does feel guilt.
Right.
Although, you know, we do find out that he has. He's you know living in his home because of his brother, because of the money that his brother got, and that he's basically the guardian of his brother. So he feels a lot of guilt and responsibility there. And I mean, the movie is essentially about Troy Maxson's life and wrestling with his demons, future, present, and past.
Yes.
It's
really... This is the first movie, I guess, in a long time that felt like an actual onion, like peeling an onion back.
Yeah, very much so.
Like, the very first scenes are, like, very surface-level stuff, and then it gets a little bit deeper, and then you learn a little bit more about Troy, and you learn about what his life was like when he was a kid.
How complicated his life really is. Like, before you go judge him, you see why he is who he is.
Right.
And you know, he's come about... He is a very hard man.
Yeah. So,
your immediate instinct is to feel that he's just an asshole.
Yeah.
But, as he points out in the movie, you know, he does take care of his family.
Yes, he does.
As we've come to know now, taking care of your family means different things. But he took care of his family in terms of making sure that they were fed and clothed and had food on the table or had a roof over their heads. Emotionally, not at all.
No, like, yeah,
not
yeah.
even a little bit. Not yeah. at all. He took care of no emotional needs.
No,
and we come to find out it's just that through his life and on a larger scale. Just the struggle of African Americans in general in that time.
Right.
He just didn't have anything left to give.
But not just that, but he was also a product of his time. Because as Rose keeps saying to him, times are changing. And he just would not change with the times. And for the better, which would have been for the better.
If he had changed. You're right.
If he had changed. So it also showed how being stubborn can...
Yeah, he was stuck in the past.
Yeah, he was totally stuck in the past. And it was very... It was excellent acting in this film.
It's one of those stories where it's interesting for me when I see these stories like this because he struggles so hard because he doesn't want to be his dad.
Right.
But he's clearly already his dad.
Right, yeah.
And he just can't see that.
Right.
And even at the end of the movie, I don't know if we're giving away spoilers because it's a play that's out there already. I mean, I don't
know. It's up to you. I mean, yeah, we can... I thought that was happening a lot sooner, though, I can tell you that.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So, by the end of the movie,
I mean, do you want to give... I don't know if we want to give the whole thing away.
Not the whole thing, I mean, because, Viola Davis is taking up for him.
Yeah.
And his life.
Right.
And the struggles that he had, and trying to explain to...
Corey.
All the children.
Yeah.
Corey is particularly.
Yeah.
But all his children that aren't even hers.
Yeah.
Save Corey. You know, he's a hard man, but you have to respect him for what he's done for you, even if you don't understand it fully.
Yeah.
Which to me is still hard to grasp because he was an asshole.
Yeah.
It's hard to say, and not just to the kids. To her as well.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he really, he does a lot of things in this film that you, by the end...
Despicable.
You're just like, ooh, yeah, I can't really forgive that. No matter what, you know, you were doing. I'm surprised he wasn't on the couch.
But he always owns things as his version of the man that he thinks a man should do.
Mm-hmm.
He owns these responsibilities,
right?
In some masochistic way, you know, he takes on the weird responsibilities, and not just parental responsibilities, but in other odd ways,
right?
Without giving a lot away, but the performances here are what shine.
Oh yeah, it's much like Jackie in that regard.
Yeah, and of course here even more so because it's written as a play. Of course,
right.
It's all about the performances.
Right. But it's really just like it's really I would say a small scale family saga. Basically.
Very much so. Very much. So.
It's not like a sweeping family saga where it's like this big family. It's just this little family in Pittsburgh and all the things that happened to them over this time. And like I said, set in the 50s.
Yeah. And Fences is set as a metaphor for the whole thing. Throughout the whole movie, he's talking about building a fence that his wife wants around the house. And the whole thing becomes a big metaphor for fences. And by the end, when he does end up building the fence, it's, at least for me, I felt he finally built it. It was for him to keep her in. Because she was kind of on her way out.
Yeah.
So, kind of changed meanings throughout. That was a very interesting movie. It did as a play that gets translated into a motion picture. It did drag in parts, particularly I thought that the third and final act.
Because I almost felt like they could have ended.
Yeah, I kept thinking, oh, here's the end.
When it went to black.
Oh, wait, here's the end. I was like, nope. There was like literally two or three times where I'm like, I thought it was going to end and it did.
The third, the end of the third act is really like, we really have to wrap up and show what happened to everybody.
Yeah.
But no, I enjoyed it. I don't know if it could possibly sneak in at the bottom of my list. But Denzel Washington's fantastic in this.
Yeah,
Viola Davis
for sure.
is really good as well.
I don't see this making my top 10. I mean, hell, if Jackie didn't, I certainly don't see this one popping in there. But maybe. I mean, I haven't vetted a list yet. But
I would say Denzel Washington is probably the biggest threat to Casey Affleck for best actor, probably.
Oh, for sure. He's, hands down, he's nominated. That's not a question.
Oh, for sure.
I feel like... I don't know if I'm biased. No, I don't know, because I love Denzel. I feel like Casey Affleck wins out simply because... He's never been there before, and he created that something character out of nothing. Whereas Denzel had years to work on this character and build him up.
That's true. That's a good
Although one could argue he did that, and that's practice makes perfect. He got the perfection, right? So,
but they might also look at it as you've already won the Tony, so
I don't know. And to be honest, I'm looking at it. My mind can't help but not look at it emotionally,
right?
And from the emotional aspect, Casey gets it because he's not a despicable fuck.
True,
but it's also hard to play a character like Troy Maxim, where you have to be hated and respected at the same time. That's a hard character to play.
Denzel's role is much showier, I would say.
Oh,
much
showier. Yeah, a lot more.
Casey Affleck's is much more internal.
Yes, but I would argue that that internal struggle is harder to bring out on screen, which Casey Affleck does just amazingly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. He was great. He was great. I want to see Casey Affleck win it, but if Denzel won it, I wouldn't be upset.
Now he did fantastic.
He was great.
You could tell he knew this character inside and out.
And actually showing his age in this film
for once.
He's like 61 or something.
Yeah, he's got the gray going full on here.
Oh yeah, full on gray because. He was in an interview or something like that, and I think somebody at work was like, "Don't tell me that guy's not coloring his hair. Get out of here." Get out of here, Denzel Washington. You saw Assassin's Creed.
Oh, right. Yeah, so Doug did not catch Assassin's Creed, but your old faithful Dirty A.
And after you told me about it, I'm like, I don't think I am going to catch it.
There's nothing here to catch.
Should I just rent the video game? Is that all you should do?
Look, listen, the only thing in this movie that you go in expecting is action.
Right.
And if it can't produce that, what the fuck is it all about? Right. It does not. It does not. Just because you show me the hidden blade five or six different times, does not an action movie make.
See, for me, the thing that bothers me, and this was in the games as well, what bothered me was the whole conceit of it with, like, the shadowy corporation in the future. I'm like, just make it about a guy living in the past as an assassin. Why not? That's all you gotta do.
Why not?
But again, to me, that extends to the games as well. I never understood why they did that whole thing with, like, the future thing and all this crap, and I never understood it.
I think it's just a framework.
But you don't even need it.
But
I'm an assassin guy.
It allows them to tie the whole framework into multiple games in multiple time periods.
I guess.
See what I'm saying? They weren't thinking about it in terms of one game, right?
Yeah.
From a movie perspective, though, they try to give this guy a backstory, but they don't give him the backstory. Mm-hmm. And what they do give him that he's murdered someone, but you don't know any of the details or did he deserve? We don't know.
He's Cassian Andor.
But all of a sudden he's some form of a hero. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Okay.
And then the end of this movie could not have been scripted to be more anticlimactic.
Oh really?
No. These are assassins, right? So you think assassins like Hayden. Right. They're jumping on the walls and they're coming down at you. No, he just like he walks in a robe and just literally walks in and kills the guy. There's no pretense to it. There's no suspense. It was the most anticlimactic scene I've ever seen in a movie, and it was just I don't remember how long the movie is. Maybe an hour, a little over an hour and a half, but it was really bad.
Yeah.
And I get it. I get it. Ubisoft, this was strictly a marketing measure for you to keep the people's thoughts on Assassin's Creed and keep it rolling. But man, even Michael Fassbender, it's just like he wasn't even on screen. It could have been anybody. Yeah. He doesn't even bring any kind of exuberance to his character. It was really bad. Skip it.
Not surprised. I saw Sing a while back.
I'm sorry.
I think I could have sworn we mentioned this on another episode, but whatever. We'll talk about it again. It's cute. Sing is an animated feature from Illumination Entertainment, and they are not that great. They do Despicable Me, they did The Secret Life of Pets, nothing really to see here. They're like the worst part about DreamWorks, I guess, the worst aspects of DreamWorks. Evil,
the stepchild.
And it's like, you know, and like Despicable Me like has its moments, stuff like that, and then, you know, I laugh in parts, and the Minions are cute or whatever, but when you try and give the Minions their own movie, it did not go over well. And this movie was, I liked it because it was an original story by a writer-director thing, so it didn't feel like it was like a crass cash grab, but then at the same time they base it around a singing contest where they use all these pop hits for these actors to sing, and there's only like one original song in the entire thing. You're just like, come on.
It's like a karaoke fest.
Exactly. And it's got a great cast. Matthew McConaughey voices the main character. He's a koala. John C. Reilly's in it. Scarlett Johansson, Reese Witherspoon, Taron Egerton, the guy from Kingsman, he's in it. He plays the gorilla. And Seth MacFarlane's in it, and say what you want about Seth MacFarlane, he can sing. The guy can sing.
Yeah.
And Tori Kelly, who I'm not familiar with, I think Tori Kelly is a singer. I think she was on American Idol or something like that. She's in this. She's fine in her part, as her voice part. The singing's fine. It's good. It's cute. The movie does drag a little bit in parts, but it was just nice to see an original story, nothing based on anything else, or, you know, and it was a writer, you know, the guy Garth Jennings did it, you know, it was his story and everything like that, and he directed it, and, you know, it was nice to see it like that. But I mean, it won't threaten the Disney movies, the Pixar movies, or Kubo and the Two Strings by any stretch of the imagination. Nothing should
threaten Kubo.
No, but I'm afraid that if Moana won Best Animated Feature, I wouldn't be as angry at Finding Dory.
I won't be surprised, but I'd be very upset.
Oh, for sure.
Finding Dory by no means should.
Yeah, should no means win. Yeah,
other than it's only a handful of movies, so it has to be nominated.
Right. Yeah. But right.
No.
Yeah. So that's Sing. You know, your kids might like it, but your kids might also get bored because it is like a real movie. Like, it's not like a quick and dirty kids movie. It's like, it tells a story, and they might get bored because it is almost 2 hours, that movie. And that's long for an animated movie.
I'll just wait for Wes Anderson's new movie.
There you go. Yeah, I know. Did they release a trailer?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I got to see that.
No. Sorry. It wasn't a trailer.
It was a picture or something?
It was a promo.
Oh, okay.
So it was Wes Anderson announcing the movie,
okay,
and then like he starts naming like all the cast in it,
mm-hmm,
and he names like 20 people,
mm-hmm,
and then he's like, I feel like I'm missing someone, and like Ed Norton pops his head out from the back. He's like, I'm in it.
He's like, the main guy, right?
Yeah. He's like, oh yeah, and Ed Norton's in it.
For those who don't know, his Wes Anderson's next movie is going to be in the vein of Fantastic Mr. Fox. It's going to be another stop motion animated movie.
Yeah, I think I'm not 100% sure. I think this is an original story.
I believe so, yes. Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah. So anyway.
So let's talk about Passengers. This is a movie that the trailers came out and people were like, oh, it's Titanic in space. Guess what? No, it is not.
Oh, did people say that with the trailers?
Yes. Okay. People thought it was going to be Titanic in space, okay, with like maybe some thriller aspect to it or some action aspect to it.
I didn't know if that was a before or after thing.
Oh, no, no, no.
We're talking about it with
Titanic. No, it makes no sense that it is after. basically, this was directed by Morten Tildum, who did one of our favorite movies from a couple years ago, The Imitation Game.
Okay.
He directed this, and it was written by John Spates, who is a guy whose name you see pop up a lot. He was the original writer on Prometheus. He wrote something else I can't remember off the top of my head. I think he worked on Doctor Strange.
Okay.
So you see his name pop up a lot. He's most associated, I think, with Prometheus before this. But then they brought in Damon Lindelof to probably fuck it up. Who knows? But he gets sole billing on this, so he takes all the blame from me. Maybe not so much you, but this movie is set in an undetermined future time.
They don't really tell you when, but it's
clearly a much more technological future.
Yeah.
And there's a colony ship. I don't call it a generation ship, even though it is a generation ship, because this isn't a ship that's trying to save the Earth, as is usually the case in these kinds of stories. It's literally
a capitalistic thing.
Yes, it's a colonization ship where this company, what was it called? The Homestead Corporation owns these planets, basically. They own these colonies on these colony planets, and they basically have people sign up and go there because Earth has essentially become one big New York City, as from what I can tell.
Yeah.
It's too expensive to live there.
It's become way expensive.
Right. But this isn't a case of like the Earth was destroyed by climate change. No, nothing like that.
Earth is still there. People are still flourishing. Sure, it's overpopulated.
It's overpopulated, but yeah. So people go to these colony planets to basically get away from the Earth. Yeah.
Well, as you find out, different reasons.
True. Yeah. But it's essentially what they're doing is they're moving to the suburbs. It's basically what they're doing.
it's the equivalent now of, you know, Elon Musk having people spend money to buy a ticket for SpaceX to go to outer space. This is just the next evolution of that.
So what happens is the journey to this Homestead 2 planet takes 120 years. And so they have to put the people into hibernation pods, cryosleep, basically. And there is a scene in the beginning where the ship goes through this, and the ship is run completely by computer.
It's a completely autonomous ship. It does have a crew that, but they are also in
hypersleep too. Yeah, and they hypersleep. That's alien, isn't it? Isn't that their term for it?
I'm not sure what they call it.
They call it a hibernation. Okay. Hibernation. What's supposed to happen is that when they get 5 months out from the planet, the crew is supposed to wake up, and then they're 4 months out. All the 5,000 colonists,
yes, sir, 5,000 people on the ship. So they all get time to get adjusted, and so they live for 4 months on the ship, which is basically a huge city.
But it's essentially a luxury cruise line.
Yeah, it's its own community.
It's a Royal Caribbean in space.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. Yeah,
which is actually I have in Maxim Ultra, but that's more of a Royal Caribbean where it's like an actual cruise ship. But anyway, so what happens is the ship, which is being run all by computers at this point, hits an asteroid belt, but it's like what's the word I'm looking for? An uncharted asteroid belt. Like, it wasn't right. It wasn't planned to be in their chart.
Yeah,
it was probably two meteorites collided and created this.
It just
field.
Came there. Now it does have like big giant shields to shield itself from things like this, but
it's
too happened
big.
To be too big.
Right. So the ship gets damaged, and one of the hibernation pods opens up early, and this is Chris Pratt's pod. And so he wakes up, and his name's Jim. And he wakes up, and he is 90 years too early to wake up.
Which he finds out very quickly.
Now, he loses his shit, as you would, and he tries to break into the bridge, and he can't get in, and because he doesn't have permissions to get into the bridge and all this kind of stuff. So he's basically like, he's going to live out his life by himself on this ship. Alone.
Yeah.
Not entirely alone, because he does have the android Arthur in the bar to talk to.
Michael Sheen plays the comedy element.
Right, he plays the bartender who's an android. And this isn't like, there are robots that serve in other restaurants, but they are strictly automatons.
They aren't interfacing.
Yeah, Arthur.
He's the sole interfacing android on the ship.
Arthur is an AI, so he can actually communicate. He doesn't understand the
AI
existential.
To some degree.
He doesn't understand the existential crisis that Jim is facing, but he can at least have someone to talk to.
Yeah.
He's got more than Tom Hanks had.
Got a dialogue.
He's got more than Tom Hanks had on that island in Castaway. Okay.
Yes.
He's not having the conversations in his head with Wilson. Wilson can talk back. So. He lives on the ship for about a year, and then he starts losing his mind because he has a big mountain man beard.
He's got a big...
he's got the Chris Farley hibernation, the NyQuil beard.
The NyQuil beard. I was thinking more of
the Hibernol.
Michael C. Hall at the end of Dexter.
Yeah.
He got the big, big burly beard.
Without really going into tons of detail, he attempts suicide.
Yeah, he does. He realizes quickly he can't do it.
Right.
He can't bring himself to kill himself,
right.
kind of thing.
So
he gets fixated on
one of the colonists
simply by luck of the draw. Like, he looks over as he's having this existential crisis.
Yeah, lucky her.
I'm just saying, this is why it could have been anybody.
I know, but
so he looks over, sees her, and he decides to kind of treat her as a friend. So he goes and finds her bio and learns about her, and he'll sit beside her and read to her, kind of thing, right? And talk.
He reads her stuff. She's a journalist.
Yeah. So yeah, that's right. So he reads her books that she's written and stuff, and then he conversates with her clearly on a one way conversation. You act like it's you keep shaking your head like it's the creepiest thing you've ever heard of, and I'm sorry, but it's not that bad. If you're sitting there alone for a year, it's not the creepiest fucking thing in the world to look at someone else who's right there and be like, I wish I could have a conversation with this person.
But it's the way they go about it.
I don't think so.
He looks up all the information about it. It's like, it's almost like he becomes like a cyber stalker.
Yeah, but I would do that too. It's all he had. It's all he had. The information is there.
I don't know.
The information is there.
They make it way creepier than it had to be.
I hate to say it, Doug, but people do that today. It's called Facebook. Oh. It's called dating profiles. Same thing. They're just bios. It's not like she's got her innermost secrets in there. It's literally just bios of people.
I don't know.
It's not like personal thoughts.
It came across as really creepy in the movie.
I did not think so.
It came across as really creepy.
And I think that is our main difference here.
Right.
You saw it as really creepy. I saw it as I understood.
Basically what happens is
so he decides to wake her up. But it isn't like he just decides. He wrestles with it. He's like, I'm not gonna do it. He has the conversation with
Arthur,
Michael Sheen's character, saying, I can't do this, or try to talk me out of this. But of course, as you mentioned before, Michael Sheen can't answer these existential problems. Right. So when he's telling him, like, I just want someone to talk to, of course Michael Sheen's just like, yeah, that'd be a great idea, you know, like, yeah, just of course. So, yes, he wakes her up. He wakes her up by reading about the manual. He's a mechanic.
Right.
He's an engineer, and that's actually why he was able to get on the ship, because
he has a skill that they need.
Even the ship has classes. You know, different monetary people get different things.
Not as bad as Snowpiercer,
right?
You know,
but I kind of thought about that. Right, it's the same thing that even this ship has these class levels, and he is the worker class. And the only way he was able to afford a ticket was because of his trade,
right?
Because he would be able to work it off,
right,
as a laborer on the colony,
right?
So in any case, she of course is more of an elite class, because her father had money, I think, right? Is family money?
Yeah, because he was a famous writer, too.
Right. So, he reads up about this because he knows how to do this stuff. He ends up opening up her pod. He doesn't let her know that, hey, I did this. He kind of, like, opens it up, then he's like, oh shit, I'm, runs away. Lets her kind of...
Well, don't put it like that. That was always the plan. The plan was always to play it off like it was an accident.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, what did I say?
Because you made it sound like he was just like, oh no, like you almost sound like he was gonna sit there and just be like, hey, you're awake, and then he chickened out. No, the plan was always to be like,
oh right,
oh, what happened?
Yeah, they don't really address whether that was the plan or not. The crisis was whether he was gonna wake up or not, not how he would handle it when he did.
Right.
But I don't disagree with you. In any case, she wakes up. He kind of lets her. I don't know how long. I don't know if it was a day or hours, but
hours.
She's roaming around figuring out the same thing, and then he comes into the picture. It's like, oh, hey.
Yeah.
And then she immediately pretty much finds out that he's been awake for a year.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know how much of this talk about, because it's so... They form a relationship, of course. They form a bond because they're the only fucking two people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, literally lack of choices. But clearly, he knows...
Like prison.
Clearly, he knows a lot about her.
Yeah.
Because he's read up on her. So, he tailors conversations towards what he thinks she'd like.
By the way, you left out the most important part.
I probably did.
Her name is Aurora.
Oh, yes.
Like Sleeping Beauty. I mean, can you get any fucking...
Sleeping Beauty's name.
Can you get any more fucking precious than that?
I didn't even know that.
So
the first two acts are kind of more the psychological.
She falls in love with him, basically. Yeah. And
So we'd say act one is his existential crisis.
Right.
Act two is their love story, I guess.
Sure.
Right?
Sure. And their manufactured love story.
And then act three comes the exterior crisis.
Right. And so what happens is the ship throughout all this time has been having more and more problems. They constantly cut back to the bridge where there's like these red alerts coming up that the ship can't fix.
Which I was at least glad they did that, because I didn't feel
oh, like, oh no,
I
yeah,
was,
yeah.
I was all of a sudden thrown into something.
But see, my problem is this. Okay. This is my problem, because when he does that act, we were talking about when he wakes her up.
Oh yeah.
We were talking about Fences, you know, and how, you know, we find out stuff about him. You're just like, ugh. To me, that completely irreparably damages his character. And you're just like, wow, that's a shitty thing to do. Because it's like, I can't kill myself, but I'll gladly murder you by waking you up. I mean,
that's where we disagree.
It's incredibly selfish.
He was going crazy. He wasn't even in his right mind when he did it.
I don't know. He was debating it.
Well, yeah, but he was going bonkers. I'm not saying he was completely crazy, yeah, but the so man's he, on his last.
And the other thing is too about this ship. This is like supposed to be like this like luxury cruise ship. I mean, yeah. And if you're in any hotel or anything like that, I felt that if he was going to come to this decision, it should have taken longer than that.
Longer than a year.
Yes, he should have been. He should have been completely out of shit to do.
5 years.
Yeah, he should, like, I mean, because again,
I'll give you that.
Going back to Castaway, I mean, he was on that island for 4 fucking years.
They could have made it longer.
Yeah, because
I don't know if there's a reason why they did that or not.
Well, because of what was happening with the ship.
Oh, sure.
So then, what happens?
You could have made that take longer, too, I guess. Technically,
but then, the ship's having all these problems and failures across the ship, and then it wakes up another guy. And then you're like, well, then why did you have him have to wake her up when the ship could have woken her up? I felt the movie could have been a better movie, a better story, if the ship accidentally woke her up and then they hated each other. That would have been a more
learn to love each other.
Right. To me, that would have been a far more interesting story than hey, I'm going to wake you up and you're going to fall in love with me because you have no choice, basically, because I've boned up on you.
Yeah.
You know, it's like. So,
but yeah, they introduce Lawrence Fishburne.
Fishburne comes in, and he is a crew member.
Yes, was he? No, he wasn't the captain.
No. Yeah. Easiest money Andy Garcia ever made. So, Larry Fishburne wakes up, and he is a crew member, so he has access to other stuff, and then he gets them onto the
literally
bridge.
The only reason for his character was to get the. I felt like they could have just taken it from him or found the bracelet or. Something I felt there was a better way to get them to grant them this access rather than having him show up to basically, spoiler alert, just die.
Yeah, and yeah, because his pod was fucked up because of all the problems with the ship, so he has like all these problems now. He's like basically coming out like.
Unfortunately, I guess Chris Pratt was able to. His pod opened up probably more gracefully or something like that.
No. I think what happened was Larry Fishburne's had like some kind of leak or something like that. So like it was like kind
the
of
pod
open.
Itself was...
And so he wasn't really in hibernation. So he was really kind of aging faster or something. Gotcha. I don't know what it was.
Anyway.
But they didn't really explain it. To me, the other part, the other problem, the other reason why I gave this movie a D+ in my review is not just because of, I just completely disagree with what they did with Chris Pratt, but also because the third act evolves into total sci-fi schlock. I mean, and and we'll talk about it. But so he gets them on the bridge and all this kind of stuff. And then when they tell him what happened, he's like, hey, so wait, you opened her pod. And they're like, he's like, yeah. And he's like, he's like, oh my God, that's fucked up. But you know, what are you going to do? And I'm just like, what? I'm like, you should be like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
I guess we're just on different morality scales. Cause I that's how I would have reacted. I'm like, well, I kind of get it.
No, see, I mean, on the one end of the spectrum, I do understand where the character was coming from. But then there's also, you know, Chris Rock's famous line: "You just don't do it." You just don't do it. You know, because with all these problems with the ship, you know, maybe they open up Penelope's.
Here's what I say to you on that. I don't need you to buy into the fact that you would do it.
Right.
But you can buy into the fact that one would do that. That there are people that would do that.
Right.
That's
okay,
all
so,
you have to buy into.
Right. But because that conflicts with what I would do, completely conflicts with what I would do.
Well,
then
makes
I'm like,
half the movies in the world inaccessible to you.
Not necessarily.
Because
the crux of the movie.
I would never shoot somebody, so I can't believe this guy would shoot somebody. It's the same idea. It's murder.
Really.
You're talking about murder.
This is no, it, and it's also the way they went about it.
You're right.
A very creepy way.
I also feel that they should have taken longer than a year.
I mean, you know, it's like, you know, I'm sorry if you're that hard up.
I don't know if it matters, but we didn't mention how she found out because she found.
Oh
out.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
the best.
We did
because as in all sci-fi movies, the robot fucks it up.
Right.
So
he
tells the robot. He says, "Hey, never tell her about this. Yeah. This is our secret." And then a year later. He tells the robot inadvertently, just like, there's no secrets between us. So the robot
the
thinks,
robot's like, oh, no secrets
so,
anymore.
So she must know.
And he's literally like about to propose to her, like on this ship.
I was cackling when this happened because I was like, you deserve this.
I agree. He deserved it. Absolutely. I'm not defending him like as doing the right thing.
Right.
I'm just saying I understand the thought process that came with that.
Right.
But yeah, so the robot says, basically hears, oh, there are no more secrets. And then he's just like, the robot, essentially when Chris Pratt walks away, he's just like, oh, I'm so glad you two are happy together. After he woke you up, he really grappled over that. Thought you wouldn't like it very much. And she's like, what?
And she reacts as one would to find out you've just been murdered.
See, at least she didn't act like, oh, well, that's
so
okay.
Basically what it boils down to is, like, you see more of Chris Pratt's point of view, whereas I see more of Jennifer Lawrence's point of view, where I'm just like, hey, what the fuck,
dude? No, I completely see Jennifer Lawrence's point of view. I think it was a despicable act.
Right.
What I'm saying, though, is that I understand the thought process that came with him doing
right.
it.
All right.
But so of course after that, this is leading into the third act.
Right.
She hates him.
They cut off all contact.
Yeah.
Then Larry Fishburne wakes up.
Enter Larry Fishburne. Right.
And then they find out that
they need a mediator.
Yeah. They find out the ship is in much dire straits than they thought. And now, Larry Fishburne dies, and then they have to, not even the magical auto doctor could save him, which we'll get to at the end.
Yeah, that was fucking kidding me.
Like, we'll get to how much I hated that. Then,
like, three or four times someone can die. Come on.
Yeah. So then they have to save it and, save the ship. There's like a big chunk of rock that's stuck in the engine room, which I guess they couldn't get into because they didn't have Larry Fishburne's thing.
Yeah.
So, they have to vent the engine. The engine's building up all this heat.
The engine's literally got a big ball of fire running.
Yes,
it,
yes.
You can't escape.
And Chris Pratt goes, well, let me take this plastic and metal door. This will protect me. And so he goes out in the spacesuit. Because
to be fair, he doesn't think it'll actually protect him. He clearly expects to die if it comes to
But it does.
But it does.
But
true.
The ship has this thing, and it felt like there was only two spacesuits. I'm just like, that's a shitty attraction to have on
your fuck. You got 5,000 people. Why are there literally only two spaces?
The line for that must be long as hell.
And I get that he's been on the ship a year, so I'm sure he's explored every aspect of it, probably inside and out.
Right.
But I also felt like he just seemed to know too much about the inner workings.
Right. And that's what I'm talking about. But it took too long. It's like, you know, like they show him playing basketball by himself. You know, and he scores like a million points or whatever, and he's like, he gets real bored with that real fast. I'm like, is that really there's all to do on the ship is play basketball? I'm like, come on, man. It's like, this is the future. It's like, there's probably like every book you could ever want, any movie you probably want, you can probably watch.
Well, they show him watching movies. They show him playing Dance Dance Revolution. I mean, they can't show him doing every thousand activities.
They should.
They give you the examples that he is doing things, but he clearly gets bored doing them by himself.
Apparently, he's not watching porn.
I mean, it's no different than it is way different. but it's the same idea of after a while, you extrapolate it when you talk about prisoners being put in solitary confinement.
Right,
they
go
crazy in weeks. This is a year of someone literally by himself. So
on a giant ship.
Extrapolate. But in any case, that is not the big problem we're talking about right now.
Right. So he goes outside because he's got to hold the door open to vent the engine. And then...
Well, he's hoping he can just fix the door.
Open it and then go away.
And then go away.
But no, he has to hold it open.
Yeah.
And then this cone of fire comes out when she vents the engine. And of course, now she doesn't want to do it because now she loves him, of course. She totally forgot all the other stuff.
I don't think
happened.
She forgot. I think in her mind, though, she's just like, fuck, I don't want to be alone either.
True.
I think
they should have done is then at the end, then he's dead. And then she goes,
opens
now
up
she opens up.
That would have been interesting to flip it like that. But I honestly think, I mean, yeah, of course she does definitely say she loves him. But I think initially it's, fuck, I don't want to be alone.
So they, the cone of fire does not completely incinerate him as it should, because that's one magic door he's got, and then he does get blown into space.
Yeah, blown into space.
His suit is damaged.
Which at this point you think, well, all is lost.
No.
Clearly this is the second time where he should die.
His suit is damaged and he's leaking oxygen and he's getting exposure in space. Here's a spoiler alert. He's not playing Star-Lord in this one.
Right.
So
here's another spoiler alert. If you're in the middle of space, as soon as you got a punctured outfit, you're leaking oxygen, you're immediately dead.
Not just that, but also he's flying. He'd be flying. The pressure would be
shooting,
flying him away from the ship.
Yeah.
I saw gravity. I know how it goes. So she gets in a spacesuit. She goes out to get him. She grabs him. Now it looks like it takes like 5 minutes, but I'm sitting here thinking he hasn't been. We were talking about Carrie Fisher on the last episode. What happened with her and her heart attack? Probably about 10 minutes without oxygen.
Oh yeah,
he easily an hour. Easily an hour.
I mean, it probably takes 20 minutes just to get into that fucking...
Right, and then she had to drag him to the medical thing. He's the guy twice her weight.
For sure. Not to mention he's already a frozen popsicle.
Exactly. I saw Guardians of the Galaxy. I know what happens to you in space. So, she puts him in the magical medical doctor, auto doctor thing, which John Spates, I guess, brought from Prometheus when he wrote that.
And which she has no idea how to use.
Yeah. She uses Larry Fishburne's badge to open it up and do all the things. And basically, it just brings Chris Pratt back to life.
And when he says "do all the things," he means do all the things. She like pressed every button. She's like resuscitate, start his heart, and just like press all these buttons. And literally, like it's just like all of a sudden, this machine is just this panacea.
Yeah, for death. And it brings him back to death. That brings him back to life. Like once that happens, you're just like, oh well, now it doesn't matter that they're stuck on the ship because they can just. Apparently, resurrect themselves. I mean, it's just like
this life machine was the dumbest thing.
It totally devolved into schlock, and
but they had no choice if they're gonna write scenes where someone clearly should be dead three times over.
Exactly. I mean, the only way that this movie ends successfully is if he gives his life to save after what he did.
Agreed.
Is to give his life to save her and the other passengers.
He needed to die out there.
He needed to die.
And then
but they wanted their Titanic in space. Well, Titanic.
He needed to die, and of course they needed to find a way to resolve her being alone. Like maybe they do find a way to get her back in her pod or something. I don't know. But
well, they did.
We haven't gotten to that yet. Right. I meant another way. Okay. Like you know that he figures it out.
Right.
And that agreed. There's zero reason why he should have lived in this movie other than the fact that they were trying to manufacture and hold on to this weird warped love story that they created.
Yeah.
And it never should have worked. It because you created this warped love story.
Right.
Make it a warped love story.
Yeah.
Don't hang on to making it fairy tale.
Yeah, they try
like Aurora.
Aurora, exactly. Right. She's Sleeping Beauty.
And that's my biggest problem with this movie. Whereas you have a lot of other issues.
Right.
This was it. I
mean, but my see,
that's, and I'm not saying you're wrong in your other issues.
Right.
I'm just saying I
my,
see a
my,
different
my,
point of
my
view.
Point is, yeah, we can differ on that. But for me, the third act completely. It's just like it's kind of
like
what Entertainment Weekly said. They said this movie just becomes completely stupid.
Yeah,
the third act
was dumb, and not because there was an external problem. That was fine. That creates tension and action and motivation. But the fact that this guy should have died three times over.
Right.
The fact that they brought in Lawrence Fishburne for no other reason
other
than to say like two lines of dialogue and hand them a bracelet.
The fact that Andy Garcia is in this movie for literally
50 seconds.
Yeah,
we haven't gotten there yet. All right. The fourth build in this movie that I didn't even know about. I didn't even know about going into the movie all of a sudden.
Well, Larry Fishburne would be fourth build probably.
You're right.
Because Michael Sheen. I
forgot about the android, whatever. No, but literally, okay. So the movie, she saves him,
right?
And then of course, they make up to some degree. I don't remember.
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly what happens. But then, some period later, he's like, "Oh, by the way, I figured out a way where I can put you back into sleep with this
magical
with this magical machine that's been here this whole time. It will." Put you in stasis. And then she's like, no, I want to live my life with you now. So,
and like wham, she chooses life.
Yeah. So they choose a life together on this ship, just the two of them. And then
it makes no sense at all.
And then cut to 88 years later.
Yeah, whatever
like,
it is.
Whenever the people were supposed to wake up and the crew wakes up.
Right.
Led by Captain Andy Garcia, who the doors open to the main hull kind of thing, and the crew steps out, and it's Andy Garcia, and you're like, I'm like, holy shit, Andy Garcia's in this. I thought this movie was almost over. But clearly, he's got some shit to say.
Nope, didn't have one line.
Nothing, not a single line in the movie. It's just his face. And then the door basically opens up, and the concourse is now, like, literally, like, there's a tree growing there.
Oh, is it like the Garden of Eden?
Oh yeah, I guess so. Yeah. I was thinking more fairy tale-y. I was thinking more like a in the woods, like asleep. Like
no, they changed it again. They changed it again. They're Adam and Eve.
So yeah. And they're kind of like, what?
What?
And then
and that's what I was thinking
that's,
too.
That's I'm like, that's, what? That's the end of the movie.
Yes.
Blissfully. Yeah, the third act destroyed any goodwill this movie tried to build apart. It was bad. I forgive the first two acts, whereas you don't, which is why you see it as a D plus, right. And I see more as a C minus.
Right.
But unfortunately, by the end of this movie, I was entertained still.
I mean, it's got great special effects, with entertainment value, and Jennifer Lawrence and Chris Pratt do the best.
So
they can.
I walked out of there, and I was like, well, it wasn't. And to be fair, I may have a different view of this myself had I not walked in there with such low expectations. Because by the time I walked into that movie, I'd heard nothing but worst of the worst of this movie.
Well, see, I had read bad things about it too before I saw it. And then when I was like, well, maybe they're blown out of proportion. But then when I saw it, I was just like, ugh. Yeah, it was such a turnoff. And when they had the ship still wake somebody else up later, I was just like,
that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
I was like, you could have just done that.
For no reason.
And it would have been far more interesting to have her wake up. And you could have even done that. You could have even had him be like, kind of like stalkery a little bit. Like, ooh, she's pretty. Oh, I wonder what her story is. Maybe he looks up all the colonists just for something to do.
Sure, sure.
And then it wakes her up. He's like, oh my God, she's waking up. And then all of a sudden she's like, you're an asshole.
But even outside of that, I actually even liked the fact that he did it. I thought that to me, because I didn't expect it. That was unexpected tension for me in a story.
Oh, see,
I didn't
for me,
see that coming in the story. But it still could have been done differently.
For me,
that third act out. You change it, and you definitely rewrite his side of what fucking happens at the end.
Mm-hmm.
You can still change the story and salvage it.
It was just waiting for the other shoe to drop. You were just waiting for her to find out. You're just like, oh, ta-da, here we go. And it was. It's like I said, to me, it would have been far more interesting if they base it on their characters and their personalities and said they meet each other, they initially hate each other, and then they but they have to live together on this ship. There's no other way.
I feel
way
like that movie's been done. I can't think of the example.
Probably.
But I don't know. They didn't go that route in any case, and this is the product.
I was surprised that they kept it in there, because I do remember reading a long time ago about this screenplay was floating around Hollywood for a while, and I do remember that they said that he wakes her up.
Went
I think
some iteration.
I want to say Keanu Reeves was supposed to be in this movie.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah, he was initially supposed to be the guy.
But the way I read it, it was like
oh, that could be an interesting story. But it's like I said, to me, just the way they did it, it just felt so creepy and just like so like you know.
Oh,
it's like,
definitely creepy.
Or even if he woke her up by accident, you know, something like that. He was just fussing around. Oh shit,
there you
fuck,
go.
You know,
yeah.
Or something like that.
Yeah.
And then it's just like
trying to figure out to save everyone else, kind of thing, or to make see maybe he's figuring the things out to see how he can get himself back in.
Yeah, and he accidentally wakes her up.
Yeah,
maybe something like that.
But they definitely, I feel like they edited out for climactic purposes. They edited that third act a lot, because I have a feeling Andy Garcia probably had a little bigger role than
maybe
he's on the screen for. Like, my guess is there may even be a scene at the end where they left them a message.
Maybe.
Here's my other question.
Here's my other question. Does anybody think about kids? I mean, because clearly they're going to this colony. You would think they would pick the most fertile people to go to populate the colony.
But you've already said that it wasn't about populating the colony. That was more of a capitalistic thing. If you can go...
Well,
you
no,
can
no,
go.
It is. It is, but it also gets the profits from the thing go to the company. So, it's, you know, I mean, if they're all working in homestead... corporation
and, yeah
places.
And we don't know how many 5,000 pastures. They literally didn't talk about any of the other pastures,
but I mean, but if they're together for 88 years, you know, I mean, obviously they didn't live that long, I'm sure, you know. Right. If they're together for 70 years or whatever, and they're
and
all there is to do is fuck on this ship, I mean, there should have been some kids running around.
Doug,
they could play Dance Dance Revolution. Sorry,
you're forgetting the the abortion machine.
The abortion machine from Prometheus.
Which is clearly part of,
honey,
that,
it's okay. It's
which
okay.
Which was
honey.
Clearly like in level D of that of the life station was the abortion aspect of it. So there were many. There's probably a pile of aborted fetuses off to the side.
Nice, real nice, nice.
I mean, the machine could do anything.
It could do whatever a spider can.
It really was. They literally, it was almost, it was.
It was a magic machine.
It was screenwriting 101 mistakes. Yeah. It's like, we need a way out of this. A magic machine.
Yeah.
That can do anything we need it to do.
You can bring a guy back from the dead.
It was really
But apparently you couldn't bring Gus back from the
dead. It was really bad. It was really bad.
Fuck him, he's screwed. But Chris Pratt.
Yeah, because they literally said, no, he can't do that.
Exactly. It did.
Lawrence Fishburne told him, yeah, it can't do that. So,
do you look at the menu and say, okay?
So, passengers.
Pass.
Yeah, it has this entertainment value. I'm not going to sit here and call it a good movie. I'd wait for it on video.
Jackie and Fences are great.
Yep, see them.
Definitely see them. Sing. I mean, if you have to take the kids to go see it, go see it.
Nope, on Assassin's Creed.
And Assassin's Creed, stay away from that.
That's a hard pass.
That's a hard pass. So that'll do it. This is we'll be posting this in the new year. So happy new year again. And our next episode, I would imagine, we'll probably do our 2016 preview. Our 2017 preview. Sorry, I'm already doing the screw up on the date. We'll probably do our 2017 preview where we'll talk about stuff that's coming up in the new year. There's a lot of cool movies that are coming out. At the movie theater, I just saw the big stand-up. Well, I saw it when we saw another movie too, but I saw the big stand-up for Logan.
Looks cool.
That's a cool stand-up. But yeah, we will see you next time. Thanks for listening.
See you.